Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Rosemary Moskow, science communicator, cartoonist, and best-selling author. Her latest book is A Pocket Guide to Pigeon Watching, but we're going to be talking about her other books and her online comics tonight. Rosemary, welcome back to the show. It's, as always, a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Oh, it's so great to be here again.
I'm really glad, you know, I knew your comics from before, from Bird and Moon, but I wasn't familiar with your other material, and I started reading it, and I was fascinated by the scope and range of stuff you both write and illustrate sometimes. Talk to me about your passion for science and natural history. Where did that come from in your life?
You know, it's hard to say, but I really think a lot of it probably came from my mom. Mm-hmm. She grew up in Ottawa, which is also mostly where I grew up. And Ottawa is the capital of Canada, so it's it's no slouch in terms of cities, but it's not the biggest city. So there's a lot of kind of woods and nature around. And I grew up
in the Great White North.
Exactly. Yeah. And my mom would take me out and we'd flip rocks and pick up snakes and that.
That's
kind of
exactly
stuff.
So what you need. Every young person needs that.
Yeah, I totally agree. She was really inspirational, at least in, you know, making sure that I wasn't afraid of anything in nature, at least unduly afraid of anything.
So when did you move south?
I would say probably 10 years ago or so. I went to grad school in Vermont. So I got into a program called the Field Naturalist Program. Well, it was funny because I had been living in Toronto, and I actually wound up moving north into Vermont. So I made a mistake.
Get your atlases out, people who are listening, so you understand what she's talking about.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, talk to me about then deciding to make a career out of it. I mean, that's a huge deal to decide that you're going to become a science communicator.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing too, because it's not a career that has a clear path. I feel like more and more there are more obvious options for people, but it's still kind of tricky. And definitely when I was younger, I was sort of like piecing together a career from a bunch of different disparate pieces, mostly because I just didn't want to give up science or art. And I was really being pushed to do one or the other as a career. I didn't feel like there was anyone who did both of them, which it turns out there are many people, and they've been doing it throughout history. But it was just born from that, those twin loves, I think.
I think you've just hit a nail on the head of the problem, is that people feel like you have to take one track or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are clear career paths. I mean, not that they're necessarily easy to become a scientist or an artist, like by any means. But yeah, I pretty much slowly started to meet people who did both and started to kind of model a career after those. But it was challenging for sure.
Now, you talked about art. Were you always drawing as a child too?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not trained as an artist. I've taken a few classes, but I was always drawing, and I was always writing. And I spent a lot of time as a kid making books, you know, little stapled together books about, you know, my day at the beach or whatever. Yeah, I think that was kind of the start.
Do you still have those?
I do. I did a workshop for kids a few months ago, and I showed them those, and I was excited because I'm sure every kid there also makes those books. So now they know that they can grow up to make, you know, proper bound books.
I made comics. I didn't have the gall to call them a book as a kid, but I made comics, and I wish I had saved them. Recently, I came across a very old bird book that I drew cartoons of Woody Woodpecker on the inside front cover.
And oh, that's gold.
I think it was about 5, and I still have that, and I love the fact that I could see my earlier art. Now, when did you start realizing that you wanted to communicate, especially a lot of your work is for what, preteens or teens?
Well, it's tricky because I feel like a lot of it is sort of secretly for adults. I have some books for
I'm glad kids. You said that, because I get a lot out of your books, so...
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I have books that are explicitly for, you know, middle grade or younger readers, absolutely. But I feel like when people see that I make comics, they often think, oh, well, those are for kids. And I feel like, you know, no, there's so many incredible comics that are for adults. I mean, Mouse, for example, is always the classic example.
Yeah.
It's this incredible piece of work about the Holocaust, and it's, you know, definitely meant for adults. And I think did it win the Pulitzer or something like that? It's mm-hmm. like there's absolutely comics for adults. And, you know, we shouldn't look at comics and think, oh, those are just for kids, because we all enjoy them, you know, secretly or not so secretly.
Plus, not all comics are about superheroes.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had every now and then a nonprofit will reach out to me and say, hey, we want to incorporate comics into our work, so can you make like a bird superhero or something? I'm like, well, I could make a really goofy bird with giant eyes.
Woodcock woman.
The power of painting.
Right.
That is her only
She spirals
power.
Out of, before the bad guy could get her, she spirals and then paints on her way.
Exactly. Yep.
Talk to me about how it all began then. That's describing when you started to realize that you were going to do comics. And you decided, was it always going to be an online comic when we talk about Bird and Moon?
I don't think so, because, you know, I'm dating myself, but I grew up right at the start of, you know, or before the internet. So I really wanted, I mean, I wanted to like write for Dark Horse or something. I wanted to like make,
Whoa.
You know, really
Whoa,
really
so you wanted to do like a serious major comic. I mean, comics, excuse me, erase that. Not that your comics aren't serious, but you were going to do like one of those trendy comics.
I mean, I recently pulled out the comic I made in high school, and there were a lot of like metal references in there. it's pretty serious.
Was it about natural history still?
No.
Wait a minute. Well, I got to get to the bottom of this. Did you have superheroes?
No, it was all about like emotional trauma and drama and partying and
like art school confidential kind of a stuff.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It was just like, oh, I'll work my feelings out in this comic, and I sort of thought I would do something like
that's
that.
That's cool. I hope you still have those.
Oh, I do. It locked really deeply away.
Who are your big comic influences?
Oh, I read a lot of Jeff Smith, who did Bone.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I read some horror comics as a kid,
okay.
But I mean, mostly it was newspaper comics, I think. So,
oh, that's interesting.
You know, lots of Far Side and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I, you know, I grew up in the golden age of newspaper comics, so there were so many incredible. You know, Bill Watterson.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like so many nature folks were influenced by him because the Calvin and Hobbes guy. Because
that's right.
He had a lot of natural history information in his comic, which was great. There are still facts that I remember just because they were in Calvin and Hobbes.
See,
I think it's incredibly powerful.
I'm so freaking old that for me it was Mark Trail in the Sunday comics that had first of all, it was well drawn. It was seriously drawn.
Beautiful.
But that had standard like information about like the life of a weasel or something like that. And that was an influence. It wasn't an influence on me as a comic artist, but it was an influence on and gave me information as a natural historian. Talk to me about your first comics for the public that really were going to be out there. Were they online?
They were. I had a high school comic which was mostly critiquing school board policy.
Oh wow!
High school newspaper, but I don't. But let's not count that. So I had.
I want to dwell on that like endlessly. did you reproduce it yourself, or did you just make one copy and then circulate it among?
Oh no, it was for the school newspaper, so they did publishing magic. But yeah.
Did you deal with controversial subjects?
Yeah, I think at one point we were trying to figure out whether to go from a year-long class program to a semester program where, you know, there'd be one, like a class in the spring and then another class in the fall. And I was vehemently opposed to this for some reason that was not entirely clear.
Very cool. Very cool.
Really strong opinion. But yeah, my first real comic for the public was back in 2004. I did a cartoon called Bird and Moon, which was a long-form, more kind of serious, emotional cartoon. I mean, that makes it sound really fancy, and it's not. It's about a bird who's lonely and lives in the city. But that was my first real online comic, and that's why my website's called Bird and Moon, was because I bought the domain and didn't really think it through.
Bird and Moon almost sounds like a Zen comic. It's like, and that's pretty interesting. What was the tone, and what were you doing in that comic?
It was a kind of a it's hard to describe, a very tall, vertical, scrolling comic. But I eventually printed it in little zines, and I would go sell it at zine fairs. But it was about a bird who is in the city and kind of, you know, experiencing the city as a hostile place. And then the bird looks up at the full moon one night, and the moon turns into a bird, and they have kind of magical friendship adventures. Wow. And then eventually the moon has to go back up to the sky, and there's this kind of tearful scene. And I don't know, I was really proud of it. It's just very different from what I do now.
It does sound fascinating. It sounds really interesting. So it was a single shot comic?
It was panels, and I put them up maybe three or four a week. This was back in the when websites were really the thing. So people would come back every week and refresh the website.
Nice.
And they would see a few more. Yeah, it was really fun.
How did that evolve into the current comics?
Well, I think that one, Bird and Moon, was sort of a more emotional point in my life. And then as I kind of got happier and sorted things out a bit more, I really just wanted to make jokes about nature and science and the stuff that, you know, I was finding really interesting and convey some, you know, ecological concerns and stuff. So I started posting a few of those on the Bird and Moon website, and they were pretty different in tone, but people seem receptive. So I just kind of stuck with that.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Rosemary Moskow, science communicator, cartoonist, best-selling author. Her latest book is A Pocket Guide to Pigeon Watching, which I recommend highly. But we're talking about her other work. And if people want to see examples of Bird and Moon, what can they do?
Sure, they can go to birdandmoon.com. So it's birdandmoon.com, and all of my cartoons should be up there. And I'm also all over the social media under Bird and Moon, and also under Rosemary Moskow. And I'm the only one in existence, so I'm pretty easy to Google.
You're the only Rosemary Moskow in existence?
It's really convenient. it's a funny name combination, kind of like an Italian Scottish mix thing. So
wow.
Yeah, Google Rosemary Moskow, and I'm the only one.
So if you're thinking of naming your baby, choose that name. Now, there's also a collection.
The only one.
There's a collection of your work just called Birding is My Favorite Video Game, cartoons about the natural world from Bird and Moon. And I love that. I love the stuff that's picked up and that's published in this book. And I'm going to just mention a couple of them. They really seem, when I read these in here, they're making sort of weird, silly and funny comments about natural history and science. And sometimes there's stuff that's encouraging. You're going to need to look it up in order to understand what the joke was. And I wanted to ask you about that. One of your more recent comics that's on your website has got to do with hats and hair streaks. Talk about that.
Sure. So sometimes I make cartoons where it's immediately clear what they're about, and sometimes I really make them for the nature nerds, or I make them for people to, you know, Google and figure out, okay, what is going on here? But that one was part of an event that a few of us nature nerds came up with a couple of weeks ago called Invertebrate Week, which was a week celebrating invertebrate butts. So what's going on with the hair streak is hair streaks are butterflies that have a butt, basically a second head on their butt. So their hind wings look like a head. And if a predator comes to attack the hair streak, it kind of waves its butt in the air and says, bite this part. So I thought it would be funny to have a hair streak that has a hat on both ends, you know, just to look extra fancy.
And the thing is, people wouldn't realize that until they investigate it. And I think that's one of the things I really love about your cartoons. It's encouraging people to look stuff up.
Yeah, for sure. Although, you know, then there will be the nature nerds who are just so thrilled because that's their study species. And
I know.
Making a joke about them, and they know exactly what that's about, and they're so happy. So I'll get emails from people saying, oh, that's my study species. You know, I can't believe that you drew a picture of it. And so
there's a full page alphabet in the book called Know Your Prehistory.
Mm-hmm.
And I have one complaint.
What's that?
Guess what letter?
Is it F?
No.
Which one is it?
R.
R.
Raphis is not prehistoric.
Right. Yeah, Raphis.
It's extinct.
Yeah, which is, Yeah, it's the genus of
the dodo.
So that is a much older piece. That was one of my oldest pieces.
It's beautiful. I love it.
On my website at this point because paleo art and paleo knowledge has progressed so that I think some of those genera are no longer valid. Which is it's an interesting question because if you make nature stuff, you know, sometimes some of it
is going to change.
You know, just like it's going to change.
Yeah.
You know, especially scientific names. So you have to decide what to do.
I hope this was made into like a wall poster or something.
It was, yeah. So I used to sell it, I think 15 years ago or something like that. It was like my bread and butter at conventions. And that was, you know, that was back when it was a little more accurate. But
There's so many comics in this book that people really need to look at. Which living things should you study? Which is a flow chart.
So it's a flow chart.
It's good, though. It really makes sense.
Yeah, of what to study, but it's really not scientific. So it's like you want to get up early.
I don't know if I took it. And
what was your
and it all depends on how early you want to get up.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first cut.
It's a quality of life issue.
It really is. However, if you don't like any of those thinking choices, you can study fungi.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So there's a little section at the bottom that has a really odd looking fungus, although I guess they're all pretty odd. And it just says, I don't have to follow your rules. And it's outside of the flow chart. But I put that in honor of all my fungi friends who do not follow rules. I mean, if you know any mushroom people,
yeah. Oh my God.
They're doing their own thing. Yeah. Yeah. And they were all so proud of that section.
I think that's because of the nature of fungi. Fungi. I mean, when I was a little kid, people, you know, and you get the little golden guides, you just considered them non-flowering plants.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know a lot better. And fungi are really weird.
Yeah, they're more closely related to us, you know, than
I know.
Plants.
Isn't that scary? And then there's lichen, which are even weirder.
Yeah, which are kind of a marriage of
fungi.
Algae and fungi and yeast and all, and which I guess are fungi and all kinds of weird stuff. Yeah. I love that weird stuff.
So how did that develop for Bird and Moon? That you decided it was going to become, it's fun, and it's certainly fun, but it's also educational.
I think early on I realized that if you take a fact and you add some humor to it, it will travel farther than you know any ordinary fact normally would. And as a kid who just wanted to tell people facts, whether they wanted to hear it or not, I needed to develop skills to make those facts actually interesting,
right.
Or people would no longer want to talk to me. So, you know, I made comics about bogs or fungi or whatever, and adding a little bit of humor would hopefully entice in people who were not interested in the subject originally. So I think that was kind of the key.
Whenever I talk to comics people, I'm always interested in the evolution of their drawing style. And I would recognize one of your works, like from across a room. You have a very distinctive style. Talk to me about how did that evolve and how much work did you have to put into sort of developing that style?
It is really unique. Yeah, I agree. I think it's because of the weird way that I learned. So because I chose to, you know, I had to narrow things down a little bit. So I studied writing and I studied biology, but I didn't study art all that much. So I think I went with almost like a stick figure equivalent of nature early on. And but I knew enough that, you know, you have to include the field marks. So I'm really careful to include,
I know.
Include field marks. Yeah. And I also did, the way I learned to color was I used to do art for video games, or at least, you know, indie video game homebrew projects. And so I learned to use those kind of bright colored pixel art kind of palettes. And all my coloring is based on that. I don't really know how to paint in Photoshop, but I know how to make little Mario figures.
But they look great. I mean, they all have fat outlines. And they're very simply stylized, but they're perfectly stylized. Like on the cover of Birding Is My Favorite Video Game, I can identify those birds.
Oh, thank you. Oh,
that's a cerulean warbler, right at the 55 points?
Yeah.
And that's an
that's gratifying. Yeah, because, you know, I'm really quick to say I do not do scientific illustration. David Sibley, but I put in the field marks.
But you've done something weirder. It's like anybody can do a realistic painting of a bird. you've done a cartoon picture of a bird that's recognizable, which I think is really pretty amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you've done writing, too. And I found it amazing that the projects that you wrote for, you didn't illustrate. Like, let me give you an example. You did a guide to the solar system, Our Place mm-hmm. in Space, where you wrote it, but the art was by John Chad. Mm-hmm. Was that tough for you to write something that you didn't also illustrate?
Oh, gosh, no. I love it. So because I'm not trained as an illustrator, which, you know, I'm very proud of my art, but my speed isn't good enough okay. for something like a graphic novel. I think it would just take me so long. And there's nothing cooler than writing a script or writing, you know, a book draft and then sending it to an expert artist and getting back something beautiful. It's incredible nice. With their nice. Own touch. And, you know, I try to put a lot of a space in there for artists to do what they want and kind of figure out, okay, what does this artist really like to draw? And then I get back this incredible thing, and it's wonderful. It's so cool. It really enhances whatever I did, and it's a partnership. So
I was going to ask you, so do you enjoy collaborations then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So how much back and forth goes on between you and the artist? Like, does the artist send you sort of sketches and mock-ups for you to approve or not?
It's interesting. It really depends on the genre. So for picture books, this is kind of traditional, but there's a real barrier. You do not communicate with the illustrator until
wow.
you're done.
Why is that?
I don't know why that is. I mean, I think partly it's to protect the illustrator from, you know, an overzealous artist tweaking or a writer tweaking absolutely everything.
I can see that.
But there's not as much of a collaboration. You know, I do look at initial sketches and then I have some feedback. But with the comic stuff, with graphic novel stuff, there's way more back and forth. There's way more. You know, John would reach out and say, "Hey, how do I draw this, you know, particular feature?" And I'd say, "Oh, here's some reference images, and you know, maybe draw it like this." So there's way more collaboration with graphic novels than there is with picture books, which I think is really interesting.
Talk to me about writing the solar system, Our Place in Space. Did you already have most of that knowledge under your belt, or did you have to research a lot?
Oh, God, no. So that was my first book, and that was the book that kind of proved that I could do books so that then I could, you know, do other books that were more in my wheelhouse. So it's
okay.
A book in the solar system, or in the science comic series. So there's science comics on pretty much every subject, and they're all by different writers, all by different artists. And so First Second approached me and they said, you know, we really need someone to write the solar system book. And I said, oh, what about a book about, you know, birds or whatever? And they said, no, you don't understand. We need someone to write this book right now. You know, and you only have a few months. Are you up for it? And I was like, you know what? Yes, I can do this.
Because
the thing
you.
About being a
Excellent.
Science communicator is you learn, you know, so long as you have the passion and the research skills
yep.
and you know which yep. experts to turn to, you can do it. You know, you become a little bit more like a reporter. So, it was a real education in space.
Nice.
For a few months. Yeah.
Now, what age group is that for?
That's for middle grade. So that's for, you know, sort of kids in, you know, maybe sixth grade through eighth grade or so. But that one, in retrospect, I wrote it for a slightly younger audience, I think. So, you know, younger kids could enjoy it too, for sure.
Now you have two books that people, Flowers Are Pretty Weird and then Butterflies Are Pretty Gross. Talk to me about, I have it right here. Butterflies Are Pretty Gross. Did you come up with that idea?
Yeah, I did. I was so
and it sounds like, now that I'm reading your work, it sounds like exactly like a Rosemary Moscow idea.
Yeah, those were my first picture books. So I got approached by Tundra, which is a Canadian imprint of Penguin, and they reached out about the potential to do some picture books. So I wrote a book about butterflies, and so it's called Butterflies Are Pretty, .. So it's all about the secret science of butterflies. I just wanted to convey that, you know, people think of butterflies as kind of pretty and
oh, yeah.
useless, you know, yeah. like, oh, there's a butterfly, whatever. You know, we throw them in the background when we want to make something look kind of, you know, pretty and girly and whatever. And it bothered me because I'm a girl and I think butterflies are also just complex and amazing, you know, just like girls. And so I really wanted to make a book about their full grossness and fierceness and coolness and, you know, all the secret stuff about them.
See, I'm passionate about dragonflies, which eat butterflies. So
That is completely fair. But dragonflies are another one of those. You know, people think, oh, they're just kind of pretty.
Yeah, they're really vicious.
Predators.
I know, and I when I have to net some of the larger darners just to identify them, I never would take a specimen. They bite.
Yes. I've been bitten by them on dragonfly surveys.
Now, I've never been bitten by a butterfly, but I've never netted a butterfly because I always feel too bad that I would hate to damage a butterfly. Their wings seem like the scales would come off too easily.
Yeah, and if you're observing them, there's all sorts of books now. You know, there's butterflies through binoculars.
That's right, Jeff Glassberg.
You can really observe them. Yeah, you can observe them really well. And well, here's a trick. So if you crouch down far away from butterfly and crawl up to it, never breaking its horizon line, you can often get right up and just study a butterfly, like scale by scale, and it doesn't really care. It doesn't notice you.
So they are focused more on what's above them, coming towards them like a predator.
That's my theory. Someone passed on this wisdom to me, and I don't know why exactly they do it, but I think it's really fascinating because you can get really good photos of them just sneak up, and they're sort of unfussed.
It's funny. In one of your Bird and Moon comics, Butterflies of Eastern North America, you actually used photographs instead of your drawings.
Yeah, I've done that a few times, and I encourage anyone to do this because so many of us are taking nature photos now, and sometimes, you know, you'll get one good one and then 20 ones of the animal, like pooping or flying away or, you know.
It's always, it is always still strange. I, you know, in the back of my mind, I don't think it's weird, but I still react like you have a big pile of coyote scat or something. And then it's covered with butterflies. It's always such a weird thing, like, yeah, oh, wow.
So you can take those funny moments and funny photos and, you know, put captions on them pretty easily in Photoshop. So I think that can be really fun. And sometimes that's better than anything you could draw, just like a goofy image.
Do you often dig up facts that you didn't know before and you feel like you have to put them in a comic?
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes I know I want to do a comic about a particular animal.
Yeah.
And so I read, like, you know, it might be a silly joke, but I'll read like 20 scientific papers for every comic I'll be reading through. And then I'll find, you know, some fact that I didn't know. And I'll think, oh, my goodness.
Oh, man. I'm not surprised, Rosemary. I'm not surprised. Well, there's one. We're going to end on here because we're almost out of time. Secretly Spooky Species. There's a chipmunk that says, when nobody's looking, I eat mice.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Chipmunks? Okay, chipmunks?
Yeah.
I have a bit of a vendetta against because...
Well, they bite like a mofo.
So
they bite like...
Yes.
Yeah.
And they eat ground nesting bird nests and eggs. And so birds have like special chirps to warn each other that there are chipmunks nearby. And, you know,
those little cheery little chippers are really secretly... rectal sphincters.
Don't judge any animal by its appearance.
That's like, right, especially
they're
butterflies.
All strange. Yes, absolutely.
We could talk all day. My returning guest tonight is Rosemary Mosco, science communicator, cartoonist, best-selling author. Please look up some of her books. Her latest book out is A Pocket Guide to Pigeon Watching, and it's wonderful. Rosemary, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. This is so fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.